few things in the Seder. Right away in the beginning, Yehuda is entreating who he doesn't know is Yosef to let Binyamin go and he will take his place. And he explains because his father is so attached to this last son of his favorite wife that if he's taken away from him, it's probably going to cost his father his life. And he describes it, v'nafsho kshura v'nafsho. The two souls are intertwined. And if you take them apart, you're putting our father's life in danger. So you would think, nafsho kshura v'nafsho, understand, he's Rachel's youngest. He was born, Rachel died in childbirth. Right, his other son was pulled away from him. He doesn't know what happened to him. Right, probably dead. And this is the last remaining connection to his beloved Rachel. Says the Rabbeinu Avram ben Arambam, the Rambam's son, in his Perush al HaTorah, "Benafsho kshura benafsho shelimdo Torah, limdo Torah." Their souls are intertwined because he taught him Torah.
Right.
What do you see from that? That greater than what I just described as being a connection between a father and a son with all of the background, teaching someone Torah is getting a closer relationship. Benafsho kshura benafsho. Right? That it intertwines the neshamas. So you see from there the power of Torah. Right, and what a Rebbe Talmud relationship is. Right? It's an intertwining of neshamas, because Torah is the inner neshama of a person is what he learned or she learned during those first 9 months. That's the essence of the person's neshama, that everybody has their chelik in Torah, the same chelkeinu b'sorasech. And when two people share Torah, right, on an intense level, so they become mamish intertwined, that their lives become interdependent. And that brings up a halacha. And halacha is that if a Talmud, kills somebody b'shogeg, unintentionally. So halacha is he has to go to Orei Miklat, he has to go to the cities of refuge. You send his Rebbe with him. I don't know what you do with the rest of the yeshiva. I don't know what's it called exactly right. It could be talking about it. This is a Talmud Rebbe relationship of one-on-one. Why? Because it says, V'chai, he should go to the cities of refuge and live. And life for a Talmud is his Rebbe. They're intertwined, right? So therefore it says you shouldn't teach Talmidim. We end up killing people unintentionally because look what it ends up. You have to go to the Golus too. So you should make sure you get Talmidim that are Hagunim, that are good Talmidim, that you don't have to worry about them. They go and kill the people unintentionally. But you see the power of Torah. Okay. Next.
They
should
kill them intentionally.
What?
No,
you want to kill anybody at all.
No,
you want a Talmud who's not going to get involved in killing anybody in any way, right? Not accidentally. Right. Unintentionally means, when today's, right, he passed on a blind curve. That's not an accident, right? That is careless. That's what's called negligent homicide, something like that, yeah.
Rashlanut,
right. Okay. The next thing. Yosef finally reveals himself to his brothers, and he says, Ani Yosef ha'od avi chai. I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? And says the brothers couldn't answer him because they were overwhelmed, right, overwhelmed. So the Medrash says that Oy lanu miyom hadin, Oy lanu miyom hatochacha. They to us from the day of judgment and the day of rebuke. If the brothers couldn't answer Yosef when he rebuked them and said, I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? how are we going to stand up to God's rebuke when he comes and rebukes each person according to his deeds, according to what he is, or whatever. But the truth is, I have a completely new explanation of this, which I'm saving for my drasha on Shabbos. So it's very hard for me to speak about the other ones. But I'm not going to tell it to you either, because I want something else on the tapes here. So next year I'll tell you what I said this year. But let me tell you the ones that I've said in the past. Okay. There's two obvious questions here. One is, where's the rebuke? All he says, I'm Yosef, is my father still alive? Right? It doesn't sound like he rebuked them. Secondly, why did he have to ask if his father is still alive? Right? He asked that before. And if he thought they were lying, what is Yehuda making all this big deal to take Binyamin's place because of what's, how it's going to affect the father? If he knew the father wasn't alive, then what's the big deal? So the father must be alive. So why did Yosef have to ask again, Ha'od Avichai? So there's many different explanations. I'll tell you first what other people say, and then I'll tell you what I think. At least what I thought in the past. Michtav Meliyahu, I don't know if he says it here, but using what he says in other places, you can understand over here what it means. It says that there is no Gehenim in the future. God is going to take the sun and uncover it, and the intense light of the sun will be Gehenim for the Rishoyim and Gan Eden for the Tzaddikim. Says the Michtav Meliyahu, what does that mean? So in this world, people live with things that they do wrong because they justify it, they have excuses to themselves, to others, and they really never own up to the fact that what they're doing is really not good. So they feel good about themselves. On the other hand, the opposite is also true. People do good things, but they always have doubts. Right? Maybe it's not really what I should be doing. Maybe I didn't do it the right way. Right? People are very insecure. They're secure in their rishus because they have all kinds of excuses, and they're insecure with their tzitzis. What's Gan Eden and what's Gehenim? Having to face up to the stark reality of what you've done. If that stark reality is good things, then that's the greatest feeling you can have, that I know without any doubts that I did things that were proper. That's Gan Eden. What's Gehenim? Knowing without any chance of justification or excuses that what I did was wrong. That's Gehenna. Stark reality. Could be the best thing in the world if it's good, could be the worst thing in the world if it's bad. Up until now, the brothers lived a lie. They had all these kinds of excuses why Yosef deserved what they did and why they were magnanimous and not killing him and only selling him as a slave, and what they did to Yaakov was necessary or whatever. Over the last two sedras, this last, Yosef has put the brothers in a situation where he's made it very obvious, one of the problems, there's many other points, but one point of what he did to them was to show them that when I have you in my clutches and I could do anything I want with you, I won't harm you. You thought that I was out to get you, and therefore you felt justified in killing me because I'm a rodef, right? I am pursuing you, trying to take away your this world, the next world, and it's not true. I'll prove it to you it's not true. Because when I have the ability to do it, that's what he did. He set them up in a way that if he would have them all executed as spies and ganavim, nobody could say a word. And he said, look, I have you exactly, you think that I want to get rid of you? You think that I want to harm you? If I wanted to, here's my perfect chance. I'm not interested in harming you. I'm Yosef. Right? I'm Yosef. And what you did to your father, therefore, till now you justified it because this is what was necessary. Your lives were in danger. Your whole future of the Jewish nation was in danger. But now I'm Yosef. Do I want to harm you? Right? Ha'od Avichai, right? And now you have to face the fact what you did to our father has no justification. Is he still alive after what you did to him to me? So they had to face the stark reality of owning up to what they did and how it affected Yaakov. That's the greatest hochacha. That's what's going to be in the future. God's not going to come and argue with us. Right? It's just going to be so obvious what the truth is that looking back, we'll have no more excuses. And the things we did right, we'll be able to be very proud of. And the things we did wrong, we're not going to have any excuses. That's going to be the greatest rebuke. That's one way of understanding it. Second way, the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi says the following, the Brisker Rav. He says that the greatest rebuke that a person can get is showing that they're inconsistent, that they're a self-contradiction. He brings a medrash, famous medrash, which we've explained many different ways in the past. The medrash says like this, that there was a man who was totally ignorant, knew nothing, not even Aleph Beis, and it didn't bother him. He wasn't ashamed of that, but just the opposite. He was making fun of Eliyahu HaNavi. So HaNavi said, look, you can make fun of me all you want, but doesn't it bother you the fact that in the future, after 120 years, the first thing they're going to judge you on is Torah learning? You don't even know the Aleph Beis. Aren't you afraid? He said, no. He said, I have a perfectly valid excuse. And when God asks me, how come I don't know the Aleph Beis, I'm going to say it. And God's going to have to admit that I'm right. And he's going to usher me right away into Gan Eden. So Leo said, you know what? I'm very curious. Let's play Beis Din Shalmala and you. You be you, I'll be the Beis Din Shalmala. I'll pop the question, you tell me your answer. Okay, so Eliyahu says to him, how come you didn't learn any Torah? How come you don't know the Aleph Beis? The guy says, because I'm dumb. God made me dumb. I was born with a very low IQ. I can't learn. I don't know how to learn. So Eliyahu says, sounds good. Sounds like a good excuse, putting the blame on God. Okay, but tell me, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a fisherman. He said, a fisherman? He says, tell me what you have to know to fish. He says, well, first you have to know how to make a net, because without nets, we can't catch the fish. So we plant flax, and we take it and make it into rope, and the rope we make into nets. And you have to know how to make a net, because if you make the holes too big, the fish will go right through. If you make them too small, the fish will see the net. So you have to make it just right. And you have to know how to put it in the water, not too deep, not too shallow, just where the fish are. Then we catch the fish, we clean them, we sell them. That's how I make my living. So Leo says, you know, it's interesting. For fishing, God gave you brains. All of that, you need brains to be able to do it, at least as much brains to learn Aleph Beis. And for that, God gave you brains. And for Torah, which it says, is korov hadover ma'ol b'ficho v'vavcho l'asoso. Torah is a necessity. For that, you don't have brains. The guy realizes right away, he's a self-contradiction. That for this he has brains, for this he doesn't have brains. Selective. So then he realizes it's not going to be a good excuse. So, the question is, first of all, the Kutzko Rebbe says that, what was the fact? Was the guy dumb or wasn't he dumb? In other words, what was he fooling himself? Right? If he was dumb, then how did he learn how to fish? And if he wasn't really dumb, so then how come he fooled himself into thinking he couldn't learn the Aleph Beis? Says the Kutzko Rebbe, he really was dumb. No, sure. He really could not learn the Aleph Beis. But he couldn't learn how to fish either. But he realized that if he didn't learn how to fish, he'd starve to death. And sometimes when it's do or die, you go beyond your potential. Right? People who can't lift 50 pounds under normal circumstances have been known to lift walls that collapse on them in earthquakes, because if they don't, they know they're going to die. So the adrenaline, the need to survive sometimes gives you the power to go beyond your potential. If you understand that fishing is do or die, you learn how to fish. But if you don't understand that learning Torah is do or die, then you don't learn Torah. And you're stuck with your potential. So too says the Beis Halevi, in the future, when God rebukes us, he's not going to come and tell us, how come you did this and how come you did that, and right, for instance, not going to come and say, how come you didn't give any tzedakah? You know, for a person of means, you didn't really give tzedakah. So what's a person going to say? But I really didn't have the money. I worked very hard, and I really needed the money for my basic necessities, and I just didn't have any extra money to give for tzedakah. So God's not going to start arguing with you. You know what he's going to say? He said, okay, I accept that. Except, according to my records over here, at this night, you ate in this restaurant. This was the bill. This was the tip, right? This was the amount of money it cost you to get there. For a person who didn't have any extra money for tzedakah, where'd you get the money to eat in the restaurant? Person says, how come you didn't go to a shiur? How come you didn't go and learn some Torah sometime? I didn't have time. I was busy with my children. I was busy with my husband and my wife. I didn't have a minute. The Rosh Hashanah says, okay, I accept that. But tell me, according to my records, here's the phone record of the time you spent an hour speaking Lashon Hara on the phone with your neighbor. If a person didn't have time, you sure had time for that. So that's the worst kind of mussar, where you're inconsistent. Where what you think is going to be a good excuse doesn't pan out because it doesn't hold water with your behavior in other places. That's what it says. Yosef said, you know, I'm Yosef. You're making a big case over here of how much you're concerned about your old father's feelings, and not bringing back Binyamin is gonna kill the guy, and please, you know, let Yehuda take his place. And you're really pulling on my heartstrings. But I'm Yosef, remember me? Is my father still alive from what you did to him to me? When it's convenient for you, you use your poor father's health as an excuse to get what you want. And when it's not convenient for you, you don't care one bit about your father's health. That's the kind of mussar that the Rebbeinu Shlomo is going to give in the future. That's the mussar that Yosef gave to his brothers. That was a second idea. A third idea is could be similar to one of the things we said already. Then I'll tell you what I think a little bit different idea. Yosef, when he asked, "Ha'od avi chai, is my father still alive?" meaning the following. Up until now, the brothers felt that Yosef was a threat to them because they were jealous of him, and then he was trying to usurp everything they had, and he tried to play, you know, what's it called, close to the father and tell bad things about them and whatever, and endear himself to the father, and Yaakov gave him special things. So they felt that he was, you know, trying to get Yaakov's affection away from them to him and get them out of the picture. That was their excuse for what they did to him. So that's what he said to them. I'm Yosef. Okay? If all that was true, I have you in a position now where I can have you all executed. And nobody would say a word. Ha'od avi chai? Is that idea that you had, that he's my father and not your father, I'm trying to make him my father, is that still alive by you? Does that still exist? If that was true, that I'm trying to do that, I have a chance now to get rid of all of you and go back to my father and you'll be my father. But does that still exist now after everything I put you through or whatever? Is that concept of Avi, that he's my father, not Ha'od Avi Nuchai, like in the song, right? Ha'od Avi Chai. Is that idea that he's my father, and that's why you went to get rid of me, because I consider him my father and not your father, is that idea still alive? Can you still justify that? That was the mussar. Now let me tell you what I think, a little bit different answer. What the mussar is and what the mussar God's going to give us that we learn from here. The Yaakov Avinu was promised that if all of his children would survive him, he would die before all of his children died, then he was guaranteed a share in the world to come. If any of his children died before him, the guarantee didn't exist. And I want to explain that in a rational way. It wasn't just stam. Yaakov Avinu had a very multifaceted personality. Okay, he was the finale of the Avos. So he had within him the characteristics of his forefathers, Avram and Yitzchak, who had different poles of personality, and he combined the two, synthesized the two, okay? Gvura and Chesed, and he had Tiferes. Yaakov Avinu was basically the foundation of the Jewish people. He had 12 tribes, from those would come the entire gamut of what Klal Yisrael is. The Kohanim and the Melachim and the sailors and the businessmen and all the different 12 tribes, each one represented a different facet of a society that was needed for society. Yaakov Avinu had all of those characteristics within him. Each son represented a different facet of Yaakov's personality. If during Yaakov's entire lifetime he could interact with each of those sons, then they would bring out that facet of his personality to its perfection, and he would reach the perfection of Olam Haba. That's what Olam Haba is, reaching perfection in this world as much as you can, and getting it in the next world. But if any of one of his children would die before him, that means for a certain amount of time, he wouldn't be able to interact with that child, and therefore that facet of his personality would not reach perfection. And therefore, he wasn't guaranteed the world to come, because the world to come is that perfection you reach in this world. Maybe you wouldn't reach that perfection, because he'd be denied that interaction with that child that represented that facet of his personality. Yosef said the following, "Look, I know that the father of Reuven's still alive, the father of Shimon's still alive. That's not my question. Ha'od Avichai, is my father still alive? The father of Yosef, the father who was supposed to interact with me, that I could bring out that facet of his personality that I represented, you deprived him of that for 22 years. Is that part still alive? Is it possible to revive or not?" And I'm going to add another idea, and together they really are strong. And that's the following. There's a difference between Shira and Zimra. We've explained this the end of last year when it comes to the Torah. Torah is called Shira, but it's not called Zimra. Shira is something that expresses the essence of something. Okay, everything in creation, Perek Shira, has a song. Angels sing their song. The song is the essence of the thing. It expresses the essence of the thing. And the word Shira comes from the word Yashar, straight from the essence. Okay. On the other hand, Zimra is an external thing. Zimra comes from the word Zmira. Zmira means to prune a vineyard. Pruning is an external stimulus. You cut away the negatives in order to give the positives a incentive to grow better. It's an external stimulus to make things bring more than their potential. To go more. If you just left it the way it was, it would bring out the grapes and branches the way that it was. When you stimulate it by cutting away the weak ones and strengthening the strong ones, you bring out more of that potential. That's an external thing. Therefore, the pasuk says, "Ashira l'Hashem b'chayai," I'll sing to God with my life. Meaning the basic life force that God gave me, that's my song. That's what is expressed in Shira. But Azamra Lelokai Be'odi. The simple meaning is I'll sing to God when I'm still around. Be'odi, when I'm still existing. But I think it means something else. Odi means that the extra that I have. I'll sing to God with my essence. But I will praise God and sing to Him a different kind of song with the extras that I have added or developed from that essence. The Zimra represents the ode, the extra, and the Shira represents the base, the essence itself. If that's the case, that's what Yosef said to his brother. Ani Yosef, I'm Yosef. You deprived our father of me for 22 years, put him into a state of mourning. Ha'od Avichai, is the ode of our father still alive? Have you reduced him to surviving, or is he still productive? Is he still adding? Or have you destroyed that ode? So put them together, there's two problems here. The question was, ha'od and avi. Have you denied our father interaction with me, so that part of our father is no longer around? And have you denied him altogether to produce, to be productive, and just relegating him to survival? Ha'od avi chai. That was the question. That's the mussar that Ravon should give each and every one of us. God said, look, I gave you a neshama. I gave you a lot of potential. Right? Are you giving it back to me the way I gave it to you? Or is this an ode? Is something extra here? Have you produced anything in those 120 years you were down there in the earth? Right? Have you added anything? And did you interact with other people and bring out the potential they have? Not just worry about yourself. You may have added to yourself, but did you interact with others and bring out their potential too? Just like Yosef was supposed to interact with his father and bring out his potential. And did you interact with other people or did you not? So two things God is going to demand of us, just like Yosef demanded from his brothers. How old is there? Have you stymied our father from growth? And that's what the Rebbe is going to ask us. I gave you a neshama. Have you grown? Have you developed something from it? Are you giving back something more? Are you giving me a return on my investment? Or are you giving back my investment? And Avi, right? Did you interact with other people as a capitalist and bring out their potential, people that you could have, or did you neglect that and not bring out the potential of others? Did you bring out your potential and add to it? Did you act as a capitalist to bring out the potential from other people? That's also an idea of ha'od of vichai. Okay. Okay. What else? I'll tell you something nice from the Neshe Chochma. And it fits in something that the Chafetz Chaim says and something that my wife once asked me. Let's start with the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim says that these parshios of Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash all teach us a lesson. And that is that these 10 brothers had a lot of questions. Nothing in this world seemed to be making any sense. Right? Things were like out of control. They innocently go to Egypt like everybody else was going to buy food. Right? And all of a sudden they're singled out and accused of being spies. Why? Why is God doing this to us? Why am I, more than anybody else, considered to be a spy? And then they throw him into jail. Then they take him out of jail. Then they take away one brother and leave him in jail. Then they send him home. On the way home, they find their money in their sacks. Right? Then they finally get home, and they have to bring back Binyamin. And they finally bring back Binyamin. All of a sudden, this guy invites them to a banquet. Right? They think he's gonna destroy them, and he seats them down. Right? He knows who they are. And then they're framed. That the kid is framed to be a ganav, then they want to take him away. Nothing makes any sense. And they're perplexed. The whole world has gone crazy. So they probably thought that someday somebody's going to explain this to them. But it's probably going to take hours, weeks, months to explain all these details. Says the Chafetz Chaim, not true. How many words were necessary to explain everything that happened to them to Ani Yosef? That's all. As soon as Yosef said Ani Yosef, he said, now we understand. Everything fits into place. Everything fits into place. Now we see the whole picture, and that is basically how this world is. Right? If you'd see the whole picture, you'd see how everything falls into place. But if you don't see the whole picture, then seeing a fragment is very, very misleading sometimes. Rav Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich, the Rosh Hashiva in Torah V'Das, the founder of Torah Masora about 80, 90 years ago, he said the following marshal. Rav Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich, he said, the Gemara says on the Pasuk that Chana said in her Tefillah, Ein Tzur Kelokeinu, there's no rock like God. So the Gemara says, don't read rock, but Sayar, there's no artist like God. God is the ultimate artist. So the Gemara explains what it means that God can make a picture and put a neshama into it too. No artist can put a neshama into his picture. But he says once the Chazal made the connection between God as an artist, you can add other, explanations of that. He says that another explanation will be the following. If you take a kindergarten child and you tell him to paint the picture of the person standing in front of him. So what does the kindergarten child do? He draws a circle, that's a head. Draws a line down, that's a body. Two lines out, arms. Two lines down, legs. Two dots for eyes, dot for a nose, big smile, finished. You know exactly what he's drawing every step along the way. what's the head, what's the body, what's the arms, and so on. Tell Rembrandt to paint the same picture. He takes a canvas and he puts a little red paint over here, he dabs a little black paint over there. So somebody who knows nothing about art is going to say, you know, Rembrandt just ruined this canvas. Red paint, black paint. I'll give you another canvas, start with the circle, and let's get on. You know what Rembrandt's going to say? This painting's going to take me 6 months. So have a seat and have some patience. And I don't want to hear a word from you for 6 months. In the end, when you see the whole picture, if you have any questions about what each part is needed for, please ask. But until you see the whole picture, I don't want to hear any questions. So too, the Rabbanu Shlomo is the ultimate artist. He's painting a panorama of history. And we see red streaks and black streaks that seem to destroy the canvas. But when the time will come and we'll see the whole picture, right, there won't be any more questions. Because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu say, Ani Hashem, and we'll see what the whole purpose of eternity is, then we'll understand why the Crusades have to happen and why the Holocaust have to happen. And there's no answers until you see the whole picture. Because and when you only see a fragment, it looks very destructive sometimes. But if you see the whole picture, it's different. A very trivial example is, imagine a person walking into the following scene. Sees a masked man with a knife in his hand, ready to cut off somebody's leg. So he thinks he's walked into a terror, you know, pigua, and he wants to be a hero. He knocks out the masked man, takes away the knife, and drags the victim to safety, expecting now a great Yasher Koach, at least a hero's parade, and his picture in the paper. The victim looks up at him and says, why did you do that? Why did you burst into the operating room, knock out my doctor? He said I have gangrene. If he doesn't amputate my leg immediately, I'm going to die. You burst into the operating room, knocked out my doctor, and pulled me out of the operating room. Why? What you thought was an act of terror was an act of mercy, except you didn't see the whole picture. If you would have known the whole picture, you would have seen what really was going on. But if you don't know the whole picture, right, the whole picture over here is eternity. Yeah, in this world, it really sometimes looks really, really bad. Terrible things that happen. They don't seem to be just. They seem to be meaningless and senseless and cruel. But if you see the whole picture, then maybe sometimes what's happening here is an operation that's necessary for the sake of eternity. Right? Even people who die in terrible ways. But that's not the end. It's only a small portion of existence. And maybe sometimes that's necessary in order for the person to survive eternally, for his neshama to survive eternally. But there's no way of knowing that unless you see the entire picture. The opposite is also true. There's a famous Rabbi Yonason Apshitz. When Rabbi Akiva was being his flesh was combed with iron combs. They were executing him, murdering him, the Romans. So the angels cried out, Zu Torah, Zu Schara. This guy, 120 years, was the biggest Talmud Chacham in Klal Yisrael. This is his reward? To be killed like an animal? So the Rebbe said, keep quiet. And if not, I will turn the world back to Tohu Vavohu. So we normally think that means God's threatening the angels. If you don't keep quiet, I'm going to destroy the whole world. Says Rebbe Yonason Apshitz, it doesn't mean that. He gives a marshal. He says there once was a king who wanted the most luxurious robe that ever existed. So he looked for the best tailor he could find, one that was the most famous, what's it called? Found a Jew who was an exquisite tailor. And he brought him materials, gold, silver, linen, right? The most expensive silk material. He said, I want you to put all this together and make me the most exquisite robe that ever existed. So the Yid makes him this beautiful robe with gold and silver strands in it and silk and linen, a beautiful robe. And the king makes this tailor rich. And comes his personal tailor. You know, the anti-Semites who are in the king's entourage can't take this. So they go to the king and they say, you know, the Jew, he made you the robe, but he pilfered a lot of the materials you gave him and didn't put them into the robe. And because of that, he's independently wealthy. The king calls in the tailor, and he says, look, I hate to accuse you, but they tell me that you didn't put all the materials that I gave you into the rope. And I want to know if that's the case or not. So the tailor says, give me the rope. He starts taking it apart. He said, what are you doing to my rope? He says, look, you want me to prove to you that I put all the materials in the rope. I can't do it when the rope is together, but if I can take it apart into its components, you can weigh each component and see if that's what you gave me or not. That's what the Rav Hashem said. Look, I have a world, I have a plan. In the beginning, there were the materials to go into this world. Everything fits in its place if you know how we have to put it together. I can't explain to you why Rabbi Akiva has to die the kind of death that he had. But if you want to, I'll set the world back to tohu vavohu, set it back to all its components. You'll see what went into making this world, what the purpose of everything is, and you'll see if it fits. So I wasn't threatening the angels, just telling them there's no way of seeing it until you'll see everything in its separate components, right, as it went into the world. As the world's going on, I can't point out to you and show you each little piece. That's impossible. You can only see it in either in retrospect when you'll see the whole picture, or see it in the beginning when you saw the components that went into making the world. Okay, in any case.
Why didn't they see it at the beginning?
What?
Why didn't they see
the
it?
Well, the angels... Well, the angels weren't there in the beginning either. The angels only created on the second day, according to some opinions.
So it's the first
day. Even if they were created the first day, well, they were created the second day. First day was Yom Echad. Only God was around. It could be on this. Yeah, that was after that already there was a created world. Till then there was only components. That's what the Meshech Chochma says. Yaakov has to go now into Galus, the first Galus, and there's going to be a lot of tzaras, and this is with Galus Mitzrayim, and all the terrible things that went along with the Egyptian bondage. So, and Yaakov basically saw what was coming. And he also, what's this necessary? So God tells him, the Yosef Yoshith Yodov Aleinecha. Yosef will put his hands on your eyes. From here we learn a custom that when a person dies, his children, usually the oldest son, but here it's not doesn't fit, right, closes his eyes or puts the shreblech in there. They put like an earthenware over the eye and some earth. The children do that from this pasuk. Your children, when you die, will put their hands over your eyes. But he says the Meshech Chochma says it needs something else. He says you're going to have a lot of questions, right? But you know who will close your eyes to the questions? Yosef. Just look at Yosef. Look at all the things that happened to him. And all the questions that he could have had and the brothers could have had. And in the end, it all worked out, you see, with a divine plan that was orchestrating all of this. So therefore, let Yosef put his hands over your eyes and comfort you from all the things you're going to see and not understand. Understand that just like over there, it worked out in the end for the good, and there was a purpose for everything. Hear the same thing. So my wife once asked me, last week's Sedra ends in a very precarious place. Binyamin is accused of being a ganav. The brothers are in danger of being, taken as slaves, and they're brought back to Mitzrayim. And that's where it ends, like a cliffhanger. Tune in next week and see what happened to Binyamin. You know, the rabbis divided up these Sedras. They could have finished it, Arshas Mikates, another column, Yosef reveals himself to his brother. That would be a great place to end, happy ending of Parshas Mikates, and then start Vayigash, not as Vayigash, as the next Sedra, and there's plenty of Psukim. Why did they leave it in such a, they never finish a Sefer, never finish something in such a precarious way? Why is this finished in such a, that's my wife's question, years ago. I told her, based on what I just told you now, this is the precedent, this is the takdim for all the kinds of things in history that will be problematic, but in the end you'll see it's going to work out, but not this week. You're going to have patience. You won't see it now. You'll see it next week, sometimes next year, sometimes in the next life. You're not going to be able to see it immediately, but have patience. You'll see it'll work out. Next week, by Shlishi, everything's going to be okay, but not this week. That's the lesson from these parshiyos.